You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, October 16th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, from the Capitol Rotunda, Mike McAuliffe, Washington correspondent for the Huffington Post, on what appears to be a deal. It looks like the Republicans have lost the battle, but conservatives still, it seems to me, have won the war. Also continuing on, the effects of the shutdown. The final project Aaron Swartz was working on is now live and operating. Glenn Greenwald leaving The Guardian to set up his own news site funded by a billionaire from eBay could include some familiar names. Tom Friedman on cue shilling for a grand bargain that will cut your Social Security. Speaking of billionaires, apparently they don't need retirement funds or social insurance. Also, we'll get to those stories about the safety net increasing happiness in other countries. Women and corporate crime. New revelations, the NSA collecting millions upon millions of people's IM contacts, address books, but fear not, they're not doing it in this country, so it's okay. George Bush weighs in on Iran. Sorry, folks. And this story to start our day off. In California, an 18-foot-long sea creature, an oarfish, was found. Apparently, a marine scientist was snorkeling off of Southern California and saw the silvery carcass of an 18-foot-long serpent-like oarfish. She works at the Catalina Island Marine Institute. Her name is Jasmine Santana. She needed more than 15 people to haul this thing out of the water. She saw it about 30 feet below, I guess, stuck on coral reef. It had died of natural causes. She didn't think anybody would believe her, so she dragged it 75 feet through the water. Apparently, oarfish dive more than 3,000 feet deep, and sightings of the creatures are rare, and they're largely unstudied. So they have they brought it ashore, and the carcass was on display for elementary school students studying at the Marine Institute. And now apparently they're going to bury it in some sand and wait for it to decompose so they can reconstitute its bone structure. But there you have it, folks.
And that's just the baby. The mother will be coming up to find its young soon.
Pretty impressive. So Loch Ness Monster revealed. in California, of all places. All right, folks. Although I got to think that the Loch Ness Monster is probably a freshwater. Huh.
I haven't given it that much thought. So.
All right, folks. Now we'll get to the deal, the long-awaited deal. It's not a done deal, but it's a deal nevertheless, and it could be a done deal. We shall see. We'll be right back with Mike McAuliffe. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Mike McAuliffe, Washington congressional correspondent for the Huffington Post. He is speaking to us from the Senate Press Gallery. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So give us a sense. The Senate came to agreed on a deal last night. It is yet to be voted upon. Tell us what's in that deal, when it's going to be voted upon, and what's going to happen in the House.
Well, the first part's the hardest one, is when it's going to be voted on. They had an agreement, at least Democrats in the Senate believe that they had an agreement with John Boehner to take their deal, put it on the floor today, and then ship it back to the House. However, House aides were saying, no, not so fast. We need to talk to all our members and get all our ducks in a row. So I still think that's going to happen, and I still think it'll probably be today, but there's a little bit of hemming and hawing over on the other side of the hill.
Okay.
Now, as for what's in the thing, basically it's a delay of both the extending government funding and delaying the debt ceiling. You got one that goes till February 7th. I believe that's the debt ceiling portion of it, and you keep the government funded into January, and I'm blanking on the date right now. But basically, you get lots of time. The only thing that comes a little sooner than that is they get this thing called a budget conference committee that's supposed to work out a longer-term deal, and they're supposed to have something done by December 13th.
Okay, now, so let's work backwards. Why February 17th for the debt ceiling? What is significant? Go ahead.
February 7th, yeah, well, it buys them some time. It gets it out of the realm of these, New Year's. It gives a significant amount of time for the Treasury Department to essentially take those extraordinary measures. You've heard about those.
Right.
It allows them to sort of restock the pension funds and the other sources they've been essentially raiding to keep the keep all the bills paid. So it allows the revenue to come in, them to stock up, and it just gives a bigger cushion. But it's not so far out in the future that House Republicans would absolutely say no.
And why January 15th on the continuing resolution?
Well, that's because the sequestration rules kick in then for the next round of cuts. So that allows you to keep whatever the levels are now, and Democrats are agreeing to go along with the current sequestration levels. But after January 15th, there's a law in the books that says you got to cut more. So they go through there, and then it sort of leaves it up to that budget conference committee to try and figure out a longer-term strategy.
Now, is there any talk of some type of grand bargain? I mean, it seems to me there's two things that have come out of this. One is that the Republicans have sort of lost this battle, but on some level they won the war over the sequestration, which it seems Democrats never even really had an opportunity. Or they had an opportunity, but they foregoed any opportunity to roll back the current level of cuts that are really having a devastating impact. You guys have been covering that quite a bit over at HuffPo. A devastating impact on the many of the least fortunate around the country. So, I mean, what else could come out of this? In other words, is there some notion that we're going to see entitlement cuts on a table as this goes to these budget committees, or no?
Well, absolutely there are notions that entitlement cuts are on the table. The president put them on the table, so they're going to come back. It's one of the places where conservative Democrats and Republicans agree. You know, they love this chain CPI idea, which is really just a way of cutting benefits for older people. So that's definitely on the table. But this budget conference, it sounds really wonky, but the reason that Democrats want that so bad, they essentially take the House's budget and they take the Senate Democrats' budget, and they got to sit in a room and hash out what the differences are. And the House budget is really much more of a political document than an effective working thing. So Democrats think that contrast will be just brutal for the Republicans, and they'll be able to get a lot more of what they want that way. So maybe that's actually a decent negotiating tactic. I'm not sure. You know, and to your first point about keeping these sequestration levels, that came out of a sort of a quiet negotiation that the Senate leaders had with John Boehner. And perhaps they should have made a louder, more public stink about it so that people knew that they were even negotiating, because it sounds like that's where their starting point is rather than their compromise point.
Right. And so are there any other elements to this Senate deal? There was talk that they were going to increase the reporting requirements for people applying on the exchanges. Is that something that went through?
Yeah, well, there's it's an income verification requirement that Republicans are especially keen on, and it sounded like one of the last little details was exactly how they would make sure that got met. There's supposed to be some sort of IG report that has some real teeth in it to make sure it goes, and I haven't seen the actual language on that, so I can't get any more detailed on that. But another thing that was in there was allowing some sort of flexibility under sequestration, so agencies can meet it a little bit more sensibly. Now, and oddly, that was a Democratic idea, but the White House isn't so crazy about it, because then it puts all the blame on them for the bad stuff.
And so do you know if that's still in the
it was the last I heard.
Okay. This is obviously pretty fluid.
You could still drop it. They haven't released it on, and until they put it out there on the floor, anything can change.
Do you have a sense of how the Republicans go back to their base and say, hey, we managed to put in this deal the even more scrutiny by the government on your finances? I mean, isn't that I'm just curious. It's like what do they, you know, I mean, nobody's at least, you know, they ostensibly this was about Obamacare. They have nothing to show for this other than, of course, the remaining sequester cuts, which, you know, from a policy standpoint is a big win for them as far as I'm concerned. But in terms of the politics, you know, is Eric Erickson going to be happy about this deal when he sends out his email blast tomorrow morning?
No, not a chance. I mean, that's what killed the slightly more conservative version that Boehner was cooking up. I mean, you know, Heritage, Red State, and Freedom Works all put torpedoes in it. And it went down, you know? So it wasn't that much. I mean, in like a sort of grand scheme, I mean, it was mean and kind of punitive because it punished congressional staffers, but it wasn't that much different from what we're actually ending up with. So, yeah, they're not going to like that. They're going to be angry, and they're going to threaten to primary anybody who votes for this thing. But the people who are going to vote for it are going to be in pretty moderate districts. There's going to be guys like Pete King, you know, who will vote for it.
All right, so there's two questions. One, what are the chances that Mike Lee or Ted Cruz will try and filibuster the Senate deal? And then, two, how does this pass the House?
It's really interesting. I think the reason they wanted John Boehner to go first was because if a deal is passed in the House, there's absolutely no good incentive for Cruz or Lee to filibuster anything, because all they can do is slow it down, push the nation into that sort of red zone after Thursday for two or three days, There's no upside to that because they can't change anything. However, if you start in the Senate, they might take the view that, hey, we can still stop this thing, and if we create a big enough fuss over here, then our boys over in the House are going to listen to us, and this thing will go down. So I think that's why they want to start over in the House side, which is what they're trying to do now, and which is why it's a little bit disturbing to some of the Democrats in the Senate that Boehner is again talking with his conservative conference members.
So Boehner's now meeting with his caucus, or is going to at any moment, and basically say, "Hey guys, I'm going to let this be. I'm going to bring this up to the House. I'm going to break the Hastert rule, and this is going to pass with Democratic votes. Is that basically the plan?"
Yeah, that's basically the plan. You know, I mean, otherwise you're putting yourself into some really risky territory with, as a Republican, with very little chance of getting anything that you actually want out of it. I mean, they're already taking a huge beating in the polls. I mean, you know, what good does it do them to continue to fight over these temporary things?
What strikes me is that, you know, that Chris Van Hollen video that that went viral, where he was arguing with, I think it was Chaffetz.
Jason Chaffetz, yeah.
About the fact that there's no way for a bill to get to the floor unless either Boehner or Cantor sign off on it. Is that going to come back now, really, to bite them in the ass? Because I would imagine if I was, let's just use Eric Erickson again as a stand-in for the conservative id, I would be saying this is proof positive that this had to be signed off by Boehner and Cantor, and we were just double crossed.
Well, you know, you're probably right, and I wonder if they thought about that when they slipped that little change in there. They might not have. But on the other hand, there are guys like Raul Labrador out there today saying that no, we're not mad at John Boehner, even if he has to do something here, because he stuck with us, you know, all the way to here when he didn't originally want to. So they're giving him a little bit of love for that.
They're not going to get rid of Boehner, it seems to me, because he's sort of like Uncle Junior, right? When Tony Soprano was like, "Let him be the head, because I've got control of this whole thing, anyways."
Yeah, I mean, why would you want that job anyway? You just get beat up upon constantly, and these days it's nothing but really long, painful hours. So, yeah, I don't see who would rise to the fore and take the job from him, honestly.
So the only potential fly in the ointment at this point is, at least in averting this debt ceiling crisis, is if Boehner goes into that room and they basically say, no, we're not down with this. Those whatever 50 Tea Partiers that we keep hearing about, basically say you're gone if you do this. That's the only chance here that this won't go forward. Is that right? I mean, assuming it starts.
Yeah, well, that's basically it. I mean, Boehner also would have to, you know, agree with them when they say that. So you need that two part, you know, thing there, and it would be very interesting to hear the explanations flying back and forth between the aides as to why the deal didn't go through if he changed his mind. So we expect something to happen, but as we have seen watching the House of Representatives these last 3 years, it's not always predictable, even when everybody thinks they know what's happening.
And finally, why is there any belief that we're not going to see a repeat of this starting January 15th February 17th?
Well, that's why the Democrats want that conference committee, a budget conference committee, so badly. What you get in there is the ability to move legislation with simple majorities in the Senate and the House, so that you can't have these procedural blockades by Ted Cruz and Mike Lee. And if you can actually hash out a deal, it's done in the light of day. You have members sitting across from each other at a table. That deal should stick. You know, that's why they really want that. It gives them the ability to cut a longer-term deal. Now, the questions are, what's in that longer-term deal? You know, who knows? But that would potentially save us from having to go through this again in January and February.
what would you put the odds on a deal being struck? I mean, it seems
a longer term deal.
Yeah,
I wouldn't put them very high right now. The only thing that might change that is if the polls in some of these races that were not considered to be especially vulnerable to Democrats, if you start getting information back from those that there's a real problem, then I think you would see some pressure from groups who would really prefer Republicans to the Tea Party and Democrats winning.
Yeah. All right. Well, Mike, I appreciate your filling us in on this. Apparently, right now, the Washington Post is reporting that Reid and McConnell have announced a deal to raise the debt limit through February 7th and to end the shutdown. But again, that's all contingent upon what happens in the House.
Correct. They're out on the floor right now as we speak, and I can hear the echoing in this room. So I'm gonna go over where I can see him. Here comes McConnell.
Okay. Did I just keep you from getting a scoop, buddy?
What's that?
Did I just keep you from reporting a breaking news?
No, someone else will be doing it. Someone on the website, I'm sure, will be putting that out there right now.
All right. Well, I didn't want to get you in trouble. Mike McAuliffe, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Sam.
All right, bye-bye. Folks. What we're going to do now is, assuming, and this is, I think this is a moderately safe assumption at this point, that Reid and McConnell have spoken to Boehner, and he is willing or feels that he can push this through despite some type of complaints from the Tea Party, because of course they get to do it all over again in a couple of months. Assuming that we are now headed into a broader negotiation, understand the sequester levels remain for the time being, and that sounds like it's going to be the baseline for negotiations. And I think it's, you know, hard to imagine at this point we're not going to see, and this is frankly, if not mechanically as I predicted, we are now again going to see negotiations that involve potential cuts to Social Security and Medicare coming up in the next couple of months. So with that in mind, I decided to play an interview that I did with Sasha Abramski. He has written a book, The American Way of Poverty. He's a fellow, senior fellow from Demos. This is an interview I recorded for Ring of Fire a week or two ago. I believe it is still relevant, obviously. These are stories that he compiled in reporting over a couple of years of essentially poverty that we're dealing with in this country. The sequestration certainly is adding to the misery of a lot of tens of thousands, if not millions, of Americans across the country. All right, here's that interview, and let's play it now.
Sasha, in your new book, The American Way of Poverty, you spent quite a bit of time reporting across the country on the state and the individual stories of the poor in this country. I mean, tell us what you found.
Well, I think one of the things that struck me as I went around the country was just the absolute complexity of poverty. And it really was an eye-opener for me. I'd done a lot of work on poverty over the years, and I'd done a lot of work on the sort of broader impact of the community. But even so, I think I was almost unprepared for just the absolute multicultural, multiracial diversity of poverty, the fact that it went across ages, that it went across racial demographics, that it went across professional demographics. I met college-level professionals who'd lost their jobs after decades and had spent through their savings and had nothing. I went into communities like the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans, where the poverty was almost absolute. Almost everybody you'd see in those communities was poor. So I think the thing that really struck me was just that America is a huge country. And when you're talking about poverty in America, you can't reduce it to a few sets of characteristics, and you can't reduce it to a few sets of stereotypes, as too many of our politicians tend to do.
Do you think that that has changed? I mean, is there a new face to poverty, particularly in the wake of the financial crisis? But I wonder also, I mean, I know you were doing your reporting before then. Do you have a sense that the face of poverty has changed in any way?
Yeah, I think two things happened. Really, when we're talking about poverty, we're talking about inequality in America. We're not talking about poverty caused by scarcity. We're certainly not talking about poverty caused by absolute destitution, starvation conditions, or anything like that. We're talking about poverty that, by and large, is a side product of political choices that over the decades we have made that allow inequality to grow. And there's been a lot of data out in the last few weeks about the fact that we're now the most unequal that we have ever been in the last 100 years as a society, that at the top of the economy, the billionaire class, right at the top of the economy, is absolutely thriving. But the further down the economic ladder you go, the more you see that insecurity has become a daily reality, the more you see that just these incredibly unpalatable choices, do I buy food for dinner or do I buy my kids medicine? Do I pay my rent this month or do I make my car payment, which is more likely to get me in trouble? You start seeing that these kinds of choices become the norm for tens of millions of American families. So I think that's the first thing, is that even before 2008, there'd been this stampede towards inequality. And the political leadership of the country had essentially turned a blind eye to the consequences of that. But I think the second thing you see is that 2008 was such a profound shock to the American system, to the American body politic. And it had such profound consequences on the lives of entire communities, that you started to see people who had never, ever either thought of themselves as being poor or thought of their children as existing in a downwardly mobile world. You start seeing more and more of these people on food bank lines. You start seeing more and more of these people who've lost their houses and ended up in foreclosure or so far underwater in their homes that they'd never be able to afford to move. And I think that was something that, you know, again, the more I did my reporting and the more I talked to people and the more I traveled around the country trying to really get a sense of what this story was, the more I was struck by the fact that 2008 really is a fulcrum point, that it tips America from this situation of chronic insecurity created by inequality into a situation where tens of millions of Americans have literally lost everything that they'd saved for. And I think that is something new. And I think we're still seeing the implications of that play out, that this is something that's going to affect us as a culture and as a community for decades, in the same way as the Great Depression left this cultural and left this psychological mark on America for decades.
The subjects that you interviewed, the people that you met, did they have a sense that in some respects that their experience was something that was being repeated across the spectrum? I mean, in other words, did they understand themselves to have made perhaps bad decisions or to not have had the opportunities specifically, or did they understand that they were also sort of part of something that was happening in society at large? No,
that's a great question, because I talked to a lot of people who had sort of become so socially isolated and so lonely because of their poverty and because of the economic hardship, just the daily grind. They didn't have any time to really sort of contextualize it, and they might not have even had the inclination to contextualize it. And I did speak to people, and for them this was a personal tragedy. But then I spoke to a lot of other people who were very, very quick to contextualize it. I spoke to a middle-aged couple in Des Moines, Iowa, and he'd been an electrician for years, and he'd lost his job, and they were in imminent danger of losing their home. And they did contextualize it, and they talked very much about some of the policy choices that had led to the economic crisis, and they talked very much about the role of the banks in the housing crisis. I went down to El Paso in Texas, and there's a community center literally on the border with Mexico. So you've got the Rio Grande River, and then you've got this community center on the north side of the river. It's called Sin Frontera, and it's run by a man called Carlos Marentes, and he introduced me to farmers, farm laborers who had lived in the center for years, literally lived there. They go out at midnight or 1 a.m, and they bid themselves out to labor contractors. They then are put into trucks, and they work for appallingly low wages in southern Texas and in eastern New Mexico. And then they come back to this farm center, this community center, and they sleep there. And they lie on the floor back to back with dozens of other workers. And Marentas as well, he had an analysis. He said, look, we're talking about a group of people oftentimes undocumented. They're incredibly vulnerable to exploitation, and they are exploited. And he said, for them, the measure of poverty, the government's official measure of poverty, which is about $11,000 a year for an individual, he said, that's absolutely unrealizable. These guys are so far below the government measure of poverty that they're living in an entirely different reality again. So Marentas himself very much contextualized it. So I think, there's no way of me saying everybody interviewed either did or didn't contextualize it. Some people did, some people didn't. But certainly the conditions they were in, when you stop and you think about what those conditions are, they do transcend the individual, and they do speak very much to the fact that there's a problem in our society, that this has become one of the defining characteristics of what modern-day America looks like.
Indeed. All right, we need to take a break. I want to continue talking about the way that the people that you met perceive themselves. And then I also want to talk about what has changed in American society in the way that we view poor, and also how this is reflected in our policy choices. And lastly, as this was the two-year anniversary this week of the Occupy movement, what movements have taken hold to turn to change this conversation that we have in this country, or to include poverty in that conversation? We've got to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment. Sasha, when we broke, you were telling me of some of the individual stories of people that you met in reporting for your book, The American Way of Poverty. And I don't, you know, the question I had for you was whether or not people saw themselves in a broader context, particularly following 08. And I wonder also, before we touch on how American society now treats the question of poverty or ignores it, I think might be more the case. But I wonder if people who have been under incredible financial stress after 08 perceive themselves slightly different in terms of their situation, in terms of poverty, than those who may have grown up in poverty and perceive themselves within a cycle of poverty.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of how people perceived themselves and whether they were thinking it was just their own story or a broader story, I think the best example I can give here is a man I met in suburban Stockton in California. And Stockton was one of those cities that grew very, very quickly. Its real estate grew very profoundly in the early part of the 21st century, and then it fell even quicker in 2007, 2008. And I met a man who'd lost his job, and his house was massively underwater. It had been worth about $500,000 at one point, and it was now worth about $200,000. And he painted this portrait for me of what his suburban tract looked like. And he said, look, I'd never seen so many people out on the streets in my community because all of my neighbors had lost their jobs. Mm. So where you used to see that from 9 o'clock to 5 o'clock, the streets were fairly quiet, now they were all out. And he said they were all out, and they were all doing garage sales. He said they weren't selling so that they could give their kids extra pocket money. They were selling off their life's possessions because it was the only way they could raise enough money to stay in their houses. And that, to me, was this sort of totally apocalyptic vision of grown adults, people who'd had careers, people who had had expectations, who were being reduced to essentially scavenging what was left of their life's possessions to try and make a little bit of change here, a little bit of change there. And I think that was the sort of single biggest image that I was given in my reporting of the communal impact of collapse. And it sort of ties in with what you're also asking about the difference between the post and the pre-2008 poverty. I think that there's always been poverty in America. And for various reasons, there have been hotspots of poverty. There are parts of the country which have a far more meager safety net than other parts. There are parts of the country that historically have not exactly had fast economic growth. Disproportionately, those hotspots of poverty are in the South, in the Deep South, but they're also in the rural West. So there are these areas that for generations and generations, the people living there have earned less than the national average. They've had lower life expectancy rates, much higher unemployment rates. A lot of health indicators have been very bad. They haven't had access to health insurance. They've had higher rates of heart disease, diabetes, and so on. And it creates a whole set of problems. And it also creates a very distinct set of policy solutions if the political will was there to intervene. There are certain things that could be done to intervene against regional poverty. And that was done in the Great Depression to a degree. It was done in the aftermath of the Great Society when a whole bunch of programs were put in place in the 60s and 70s. I think the newer poverty is different precisely because it, in a sense, infiltrates all corners of the country. So you can be in suburban Las Vegas, and you can be in an area which looks extremely affluent. Big houses, a lot of the houses might have swimming pools. Oftentimes there are two cars or even three cars in the driveway. But if you start talking to people in that suburban area in Las Vegas, you'll find that every single one or almost every single one of those homes is in foreclosure or was. This is at the height of the foreclosure crisis in 2010, 11, 12. Just absolutely stunning levels of collapse. And you could see that in Phoenix. You could see it in many cities in California, in Sacramento, in Stockton, Merced, Modesto.
And so, Sasha, let me ask you this, though. I mean, I don't mean to interrupt, but how do we reconcile? I mean, you know, we hear of just how widespread poverty has become. Recently, we saw statistics that showed that half of the children born last year in this country were covered by Medicaid. Medicaid, which, of course, provides coverage, medical coverage, if you live below the poverty line. And half of the children in this country are born in Medicaid. How is it, on one hand, we're seeing this sort of growth of poverty, growth of extreme poverty, that it's reaching sectors that, you know, are untraditionally where we have seen poverty, yet we're seeing cuts to food stamps. We're seeing the sequester, which almost exclusively at this point hits underprivileged people in this country. We're not seeing, not only are we not seeing a policy response to this poverty, it's as if we're seeing the opposite.
No, I think that's exactly right. And I think it ties into the what we were talking about earlier, that this is really a story of inequality at least as much as it is a story of poverty. One of the people I interviewed, one of the policy experts I interviewed, was a man called Marshall Gantz, and he's at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and he's been involved in community organizing and in how you frame issues for decades. And he said to me, look, poverty is our miner's canary. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, in the olden days, the miners would take a little bird, a canary, down with them into the mines. And if that bird suddenly stopped chirping and stopped fluttering its wings and dropped dead, you'd know there was gas in the mine and you'd run. It was the warning sign there was a problem. He said, poverty is our warning sign. It's the warning sign that there's a massive problem in the way the political process is functioning. And I think that's right, that what's happened is we've got this extraordinary level of inequality that has become self-perpetuating, that money is generating money, poverty is generating poverty. And at the same time, we're seeing this concentration of political access. You see it with Citizens United. You see it with a host of decisions in recent years that have given wealthy individuals and corporations almost unlimited access to the political process. And I think what we're seeing at the moment is a politics that is largely incapable of meeting the needs of ordinary Americans and is almost entirely incapable of meeting the needs of poor Americans, because the lower down the economic ladder you are, the harder it is for your voice to get heard.
Indeed.
And I think what you're seeing at the moment with these attacks on food stamps, with the attacks on unemployment benefit, with the attacks on what remains of the welfare system, you're essentially seeing the logical endpoint of that. You're seeing a politics that is almost defined by its lack of empathy. And that's something that we haven't seen in this country for the better part of 100 years. If you go back to the early 20th century, progressive legislation was introduced to regulate the workforce, for example, in the wake of books like The Jungle, which showed the conditions that millions of Americans were working in. You go to the 1930s. In response to crisis, the political system proved itself capable of reinvention. So you had Social Security. You had the Fair Labor Act and so on. If you go to the 1960s, the same thing. In response to the moral challenge laid down by Michael Harrington when he wrote The Other America, laid down by a host of social commentators, the political system eventually was able to expand access to health care, was able to expand access to nutritional programs and so on. But we're seeing something different now. What we're seeing now is, in the face of poverty, a significant part of the political leadership now blames the poor for being poor.
Indeed.
And what it means is that the language in which we discuss this, We've discussed it as a sickness, a moral sickness the poor people are experiencing. And we're no longer discussing it as something structural, that there is a failing in the way the economic system is functioning at the moment that is generating inequality. And as long as we consider to avoid that moral conversation, we're going to continue to have people like Rush Limbaugh beating up on poor kids for being hungry. We're going to continue to have people like Eric Cantor saying the problem with America's finances is the social safety net. And it's an extraordinary way to deal with a significant percentage of our population.
Indeed. Well, Sasha Abramsky, the book is The American Way of Poverty. Thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate your talking to us about
this.
My
pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks. There is a little bit more news getting back, obviously, to the deal. It's just been announced on the floor of the Senate, as Mike McAuliffe had told us. Politico is reporting that another part of the deal that McAuliffe did not mention, and so it's unclear to me whether or not it's actually in the deal. I think people are still waiting to see, is the institution of the McConnell rule. And I had talked about for some time about President Obama seeking to get out of any deal a structural way of de-weaponizing, essentially, the debt ceiling limit. The McConnell proposal in 2011 allows Congress to disapprove of the debt ceiling increase, so these Tea Partiers can all vote against it without having the raising of the debt ceiling, without having the actual implications of their vote meaning anything. And Obama, or the president, whoever, in this case, it's obviously President Obama, would be able to veto that legislation. If Congress wants, it can try and override that veto with two-thirds, but obviously that's not going to happen as the way that the House is constituted now. So it's unclear whether or not that provision is in there, but Politico is reporting that it is. I haven't seen that reporting anywhere else. I'm also seeing reporting that John Boehner is prepared to bring this up on the floor of the House and to pass it with Democratic votes, because obviously you're only going to get about maybe 20, give or take, Republican votes to pass this.
You are totally underselling the violation of the Hastert rule.
It is a
huge
violation.
Win.
Huge
Democrats.
Win.
Big.
It's absolutely
silly. Talk about burying
silly.
The lead.
Exactly. It's totally silly. This is basically, I mean, I think from the Democratic perspective, it's basically saying we won the inning and they're still down by 4 or 5 runs. We just outscored the Republicans 4-1 in this inning. And that brings the score to 8-4, essentially, I think, is where we're at, because we are going into these negotiations over the next month without much leverage, it seems to me, other than the Democrats saying, like, well, we're not going to do anything and the government's going to shut down again. I just don't know that there's that much stomach there. So the efforts by groups like the PCCC, Progressive Campaign Caucus, the efforts of groups like Credo and groups like Move On and Social Security Works, the efforts of those congressmen in the House who are trying to get their fellow lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers, to sign on to pledge to vote against any deal that includes cuts to Social Security and Medicare. Those become incredibly important efforts, particularly now, before those negotiations start and as those negotiations continue. You need to make it clear to the leaders of the Democratic Party that any deal that cuts Social Security or Medicare is dead on arrival. There should be calls now to increase Social Security. There should be calls now to get rid of the sequester. That's where the Overton window should be pushed at this point. And in the coming days and weeks, we will be talking more about that as per usual. But as of now, it appears that the catastrophe has been averted. It's just the slow boiling burn of the sequester and the price that we paid with the government shutdown. We're going to take a break. I want to remind you, you can support this program by becoming a member today at majority.fm. It is your membership that provides revenue, 98% revenue for this program. Another small percentage, but certainly welcome, is provided by our sponsor this month, Credo Mobile. CredoMobile.com/Sam. You get a great deal from Credo Mobile. They will give you up to $350 credit towards switching from your current cell phone provider. They will give you 25% off all data fees for 2 years, unlimited data. And you get the satisfaction of knowing that every dollar you spend with Credo Mobile, a portion of that dollar funds Credo Action, which is fighting for progressive values that I am sure the vast majority of you share. They're also literally funding progressive nonprofits, not to mention also sponsoring this program. So it's a great company. They're doing great work. Check it out today, credomobile.com/Sam. You can also support this program by using our Amazon link. Go to majority.fm, click on the link, bookmark it, always buy your Amazon junk there. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee to your chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. You can buy the Majority FM blend. Download the app, majorityapp.com. People are loving it. Give us a review, majority.fm/review on iTunes or on the app or on Google Play. Spread the word. Donate your account. .com/majorityfm. Let's do this, people. Tomorrow on the program, Ari Berman will be joining us. Talk about the return to their roots, the Republicans. All right, we got to take a break. 646-257-3920 is the number. The phones are working. We are live streaming today. Had a little problem with our server yesterday. All taken care of. Hopefully. All right, we'll see you on the flip side.